Welcome to the Life Self-Mastery podcast, where we bring in entrepreneurs who have created online businesses and improved their lifestyles. Here's your host, Rohit Malhotra.
Hi everyone, this is Rohit from Life Self-Mastery, and I'm excited to have Kyle Foster, who's the founder and CEO at Runwin. Runwin is a platform for troubleshooting complex tech stacks. Kyle has worked in companies like Google, Big Switch Networks, and Juiced. Kyle holds an MBA from Stanford University. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Well, thank you, Rohit. I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. So you know, you've had an interesting journey. You know, I thought you're British. You moved to US, but how was life growing up? You know, and what got you interested to get your being product management and startups?
Yeah, well, British to US, US to British, and back again. I actually grew up in Silicon Valley. Currently living outside of London, but this is my second time living in the UK. And I'm absolutely loving being back. But frankly, growing up in Silicon Valley, I mean, I know in our pre-call I mentioned, I mean, when I was in high school, already there were people from my high school a few years ahead of me who were dropping out of college to start companies.
No.
Coming back onto the campus of the high school, and they were walking around like the most successful people on the planet. And that just imprinted me like, oh, wow, yeah, if you do really, really, really well, this is what you do. Now I stayed in college the whole time. But that was always on the back of my mind and has been on the back of my mind ever since.
Interesting. And when you were growing up in Silicon Valley, like, what was it like a pressure to, get into technology and be involved? And because, your environment really influences you. So did you find most of your schoolmates and classmates also getting into technology and working in Silicon Valley in these tech companies?
I was still early on. I mean, I was in high school in the early to mid 90s. I graduated in 1995.
Right.
And so at that point, I think I was in the first computer programming class that my school had ever offered. And it was taught by, at the time, somebody who was just 2 years older than me. It was also very, very, very far from what the cool kids did. In fact, about a million miles away. So, it was way before tech was socially acceptable. It was for, at the time, it was kind of for those of us without a whole lot of friends and who were really terrible at sports. And I loved it. And I absolutely, absolutely, absolutely loved it. Nice. Anyway, many people in my era, I got into computer programming in high school entirely because I got stuck in different games and I wanted to find some way to crack the game and get to the next level. And I couldn't do that on pure skill. And computer programming felt like an honorable way to cheat.
Got it. Interesting. And you work with Cisco and you got a lot of product management roles. So was it like a conscious decision to get into product management?
Well, it was a less conscious decision to just get kicked off of engineering team over and over and over again. I remember, it was sort of shortly after college, it was my first like programming job at my first company. And I had the chance to see what the true top 1% of software developers look like. And it was so awe-inspiring and beautiful to watch, and their ability to make machines bend to their will with code that was so easy to read and so elegant to follow. And they could get so many things right the first time. And I recognized that I'm not going to be in that 1%. And I wish that I could. I really, really wish that I could, but I just didn't have the natural skills that it took to get there. It was kind of easy to, I always kind of liked being nearby. I also found on the commercial side, like I was always going to be more drawn to the engineering and product side than I was to the sales and the business development side. And product management is a really, really natural fit. It's kind of, I joke around that it's for people who got kicked off their engineering teams, but it was also, I was kind of lucky for me, my first job after grad school was at Cisco, and at least at Cisco, product management really was kind of the power center of the company. And so for me, that was sort of when it really imprinted, frankly.
Interesting. And a couple of years back, I think it was Brian Chesky from Airbnb who said, like, they don't have any product managers in the team, and there was a lot of noise about it. But in your view, you know, what makes a good product manager, and do you think product management can be learned, or somebody is built to be a product manager?
So I've been a product manager in, call it, low ticket sales, like very, very large scale, but low price point enterprise SaaS.
Right.
And I was briefly a product manager in a consumer product that was kind of high end flashy product. And I've spent most of my career doing product work in large transaction size enterprise infrastructure, where the buyer on the other side is making not only a big purchase, they're making a career bet. I mean, they're really like, if your product works out, they're going to get promoted. And if your product doesn't work out, they're going to have a lot of egg on their face. So it's a personal, you know, large transaction size bet. And they're totally different. I discovered when I was I was the VP of product management design at Juice, TV, one of the really early TV over the internet startups. We did 75 A/B tests, and I actually asked my team of six product managers. We all actually guessed the outcomes of the A/B tests. And so I, you know, not only do I think that I'm bad at consumer, I have data to prove it. It took a very specific skill and speed to do that. I find myself, I like a little bit better product management. My particular style is where you actually form a very deep and personal relationship with many of your customers. They're driving the roadmap because you like working with them. They like working with you. You're driving a roadmap together, and you work with them just as closely as you work with the people inside your company. And it's a very different style. You know, you're not going entirely on you know, analytics of 10,000 users. You're going on, you know, 30 meetings with 10 different organizations that are critically important, and you're trying to assess the risk of working with each and how general their requests are. So I would say that product management itself is like a big bucket, but it really is totally different. Are you doing the types of product management where you get to know your large customers very, very intimately, or are you doing the types where you're really doing more data analysys? They're both valid. There's a very different skill sets and very different ways of spending the day.
Right. Yeah. You know, before the call, we talked about how, you know, there's always a bit of a friction with the commercial teams and the product teams, where, you know, sometimes they would, the teams would blame each other. And it especially become tougher, especially in 2023 and 2024, in the last 2 years. What advice would you give to, you know, somebody in the commercial team on how do you manage that relationship with the product guys and vice versa?
So I was kind of hoping if it'd be okay with you, since you've done a number of startups on the commercial side and I've been on the product side, maybe I could give advice to the folks on the product side that I've done. Then you give advice to the commercial side, and then maybe we swap, and then we give advice to the other, if that sounds good to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what I've learned from product guys is a lot of sales guys in the last 2 years don't have a great understanding of the product. And once they don't have a great understanding of the product, they fail to sell the product and to, you know, educate the customer about the product. And I think it's a fair point which is given by the product guys. But at the same time, you know, I've seen that since lot of startups in the last 2 years, you know, they have raised a lot of funding with no right product market fit. So, you know, naturally sales guys are blaming the product guys that, you know, they're not building the right sort of products. And if they're not able to sell, you know, they especially in meetings with their with the VP of sales, they blame the product guys that, you know, they're not able to sell the product because the product doesn't have that value proposition. So I think with the sales guy, I would say that it's more about, you know, understanding a product really well has been my learning, that, you know, a lot of sales guys don't have that understanding of the product and what is the value proposition that they give. And that is why, you know, they're not being able to sell. But what are your thoughts on that? What are, since you've been both as an operator and as a founder, where do you think that, you know, the friction lies, and how do you go about managing that relationship?
I mean, I think the first is, if I could if I could say where the, if I could give advice to the folks from the product side of the room, where I've spent, you know, I've spent a little bit of my career on the sales side, but most of it on the product. The mistakes that I wind up seeing over and over and over with, like I've done 27 angel investments now, a number of people from my old firm became founder CEOs that I'm very, very close with. I'm active in a number of startup communities. There are kind of three categories of mistakes that I wind up seeing product-oriented founders and just the product folks generally in early stage companies make. The first is that they think that the customer meeting is all of sales. Mm-hmm. And it's just because they don't see the huge amount of work that goes into prospecting. They don't see the huge amount of subtle like gives and takes and carrots and sticks that somebody has to do to get the meeting to happen.
Yeah.
And then they don't see the gigantic, gargantuan amount of follow-up that comes after a yes. Yeah. That required to actually get all the way to purchase order and the huge amount of risk that occurs. So they just don't see what I think of as like 60 to sometimes 90% of the sales job. They just, they never see it. They were never part of it. Yeah. You know, they never really needed to do prospecting because it's not their job. So they don't kind of get what's involved there, and they never had to get the meeting. They kind of just had to show up at the meeting.
Mm. Yeah.
So I always warn folks on the product side and say, hey, what you see of the sales job is a tiny slice of the actual job.
Mm.
And possibly you're not really helping with the getting the meeting part, and you're making that job very difficult, or you're making the follow-up job very difficult.
Mm.
The second big category of problems that I wind up seeing, which happens a lot, I think, especially with product-oriented founders or the first VP of product, they fail to recognize that when they're in the meeting, because of their job title, there's a very specific social contract that they're selling beyond their product. They're selling the ability for that customer to influence the roadmap directly. And that is not something that anybody on the sales side can offer in a really, isn't as credible a way. I should say it's possible, but it's very difficult because the job title works against you.
Mm.
And they don't get that. So they don't get that what they're actually, it's not the words that are coming out of their mouth. It's not the slides that are behind them, but their actual job title implies that the offer that they are making is fundamentally different. And I hate when I hear product people say like, well, gosh, I've been in 10 good meetings and I don't get why our sales team can't have as 10 equally good meetings. It's because their offer is different.
Mm.
And the meetings that they're not in are far, far more important for the growth of the business than the meetings that they are in. And I've even done the exercise with some, hey, can you go into three meetings with a different job title?
Mm.
And I've had three entrepreneurs now that came out of the exercise on the other side and went, oh my God, the person just didn't listen to me. Like, yeah, well, and there you go. So I think that that's really important for product people to recognize that. And the real thing is the meetings that they're not in are actually more important for the growth of the business than the meetings that they are in. And they have to make the meetings that they're not in very, very, very successful.
Right.
And then the third is just simply like their own confidence, because they know that they can influence the roadmap.
Yeah.
And so they can make all kinds of promises in a meeting and take on that risk themselves. Whereas somebody on the commercial side, if you start promising roadmap, there's a chance that your product team comes back and says, no, I'm not going to deliver that. And suddenly your credibility gets really twisted up with a customer. So obviously you kind of avoid ever getting yourself into that situation. Which means there are a whole bunch of, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? What if we did this other thing together? Topics that are, practically speaking, verboten. And I think that's something that product people rarely, rarely understand, that they can actually invite those topics. And most of the time they do it in ways that those topics actually have to be avoided when they're not there.
Yeah. Connor. You know, before the call, I also talked about that, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, software company, I've seen, like product guys become like the actually the CEOs of the company. It's a great way for them to understand, you know, what it takes to build a company, and they I feel are like the best CEOs. But how about, you know, I've seen a lot of commercial guys becoming like the number two or number three, becoming like you know, they're looking to be like the chief business development officer or chief partnership officer or a CRO of a company, but they don't set, you know, heights to become like the CEO of the company. Well, what advice would you give to commercial guys if they want to be the CEO of the company and also build the product and lead the product side of the business, because sometimes I feel they get very overwhelmed because they think like they understand revenue side of the business, but when it comes to product, they were like, no. And that is something which they didn't want to look into.
You know, but I think this is always, the grass is always greener, as I mentioned. You know, I feel like I spent a lot of time in school, my alma mater was Cisco, and that was led by some of the best sales leaders in the tech industry. And they did amazing jobs leading engineering. And they actually led from a sales seat.
Mm.
I do think that for me, especially for folks who come up from the commercial side, I think as the company grows, they're the more natural leaders anyways, because I think a company, when it's fundamentally has to be sort of VC funded in general, the engineering headcount represents 60 to 70% of the company. To make most tech, at least in my particular neck of the woods, most enterprise infrastructure tech companies reach their maximum growth at about 50-50 headcount, 40%, you know, on the engineering product side, 40% on the go-to-market side, and 20% other. But then nearly all of them reach peak profitability when over 75% of the headcount was on the go-to-market side.
Mm.
So different CEOs for different times. But I do feel very strongly that especially the people who have come through the product side and have never spent any time in go-to-market themselves, fail to spend much of their real deep thinking time thinking about how could they make the go-to-market side a strategic advantage. And the same thing on the other side. The founders that I've worked with, some of the really great founders that I've worked with that came from the sales side, they just didn't spend that much time thinking about, okay, how can our product be a great strategic advantage? If we just built X, or if we just built Y, we could really clean out the competition. A little bit of thought, but not deep, deep thought. So I do think on both sides, in fact, the blind spot is just not spending the deep thinking time and spending a lot of conversations to say, how could we make, I have no background on the product side. What could we build in the next 6 months that is sustainable economic moat? Or on the product side, how can we think about go to market over the next 6 months that gives us sustainable differentiation in the marketplace?
Mm.
And they just don't spend the time.
Yeah.
They just don't have the time on the calendar to think deeply about it.
Mm, got it. Interesting. And recently Jason Lemkin talked about, how HubSpot, even before they got into an IPO, they were selling to SMBs. When do you think is the right time for a startup to start selling into enterprise? Obviously, you would want to go to, selling to SMBs or mid-market, but when do you think is the right time and what needs to change so that, the sales team starts selling into enterprise clients?
I mean, incredibly product specific and frankly, I think buyer specific. I think depending on the function, some SMB buyers look a lot like their enterprise counterparts. And then some functions, the SMB buyers look absolutely nothing like their enterprise counterparts and have totally different needs. So every product will be different. I still love, Gaurav Garg, actually from Lightspeed, from his days when he was a VP product at Splunk, I really loved, he kind of parroted something to me that I took away. He said, hey, the way that we thought about it is we had a single player game.
Mm.
The product was really useful for one person and it's a $3,000 to $5,000 credit card swipe. We had the multiplayer game when the product was really useful for a team and a single team manager. We had about a $25,000 purchase. These numbers have changed a lot since. And then we had the massive multiplayer game, which is when many, 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 many teams are using our product. And now suddenly we're doing features for these many teams to discover each other in the large enterprise. And we're suddenly talking about aggregating all of their purchases into one large, multi-million dollar sale.
Mm.
And I like that metaphor because it, to me, it naturally fits with, there are different price points, there are different feature sets, there are different user and buyer considerations that are involved, and very different go-to-market considerations, because somebody spending all their days upselling people to the massive multiplayer game needs to know something completely different from somebody who's trying to get somebody to try the single player game once, or somebody who's trying to get somebody to go from single player game to like maybe multiplayer game as they bring in two or three of their colleagues. Completely different skill sets, completely different techniques.
Mm.
I like that single player, multiplayer, massive multiplayer metaphor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. And how do you change who you build your product for? Is it the buyer or the user? of the product?
In my particular neck of the woods with enterprise infrastructure, therein lies countless hours of design debates and are we getting the balance right? Oh my God, I mean, I've had two of those today. It's really hard. I mean, it is really, 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 really hard. Like, are you designing, you know, for the perfect executive demo? Are you designing for, you know, the 3-hour workshop when everybody's going to try it for the first time? Or are you really designing somebody who's been using the thing for 6 months? They're now an expert and they need a very different user experience than somebody who's trying it for the first time. Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Endless debates. And oddly enough, I think that's where actually AI, I think the wave is starting to crest there, the idea that every vendor would build a chatbot into their product. I don't think that that's going to sustain, but I think that was a lot of the initial, called 2023 AI wave.
Right, yeah. And you know, interesting, you talked about AI. Do you think AI will remove the importance and the focus on UI? Especially with,
I would say my ISP in, you know, when, as I was leaving from the US, moving to the UK,
right,
their customer service was done through a chatbot.
Mm.
And they clearly spent God knows how much R&D on this chatbot. And I'm sure the chatbot has gotten vastly better with LLMs. And, you know, this chatbot could apologize to me over and over and over again because the web page used to schedule my service disconnection was down and had been down for 2 weeks. Like, I think that there's kind of a limit to how good these things can get when the capabilities that they have behind them are fundamentally limited.
Mm.
So I think what we'll see is, in many ways, the same way that mobile was a new UI.
Yeah.
And, you know, from called 2007, 2014, like it was a new UI critical for consumer products, and it was a new UI for some enterprise products. And then it gradually became kind of a very, very, very critical UI for the vast majority of products, at least that I know of in my field. I think that natural language interfaces are going to be very, very, very similar. That means that they're gigantic. They're also not going to eat the entire world, but they're a really important consideration to contend with. It's like in 2010 saying, oh, we don't think that mobile is important. Mobile is always important.
Yeah, yeah. Got it. And do you think product speed is possibly the most important thing when it comes to product, like shipping the product and the speed?
You know, a lot of people talk about speed. I think that the most important thing to look at is impact per quarter. Because it's really, really easy to work on lots and lots of low impact features. Incredibly easy. Most teams that I know, and certainly I'm more guilty of it than most, spend a lot of time every quarter working on features that are low impact. And figuring out how to work on the highest impact features per quarter is really hard. I'd say Cisco, because it was very sales-led and had a very sales-centric DNA, was extraordinarily good at that.
Mm.
If you couldn't recite as a PM at any level in the company, from individual contributor PM all the way up to SVP, if you couldn't say, here are my top 10 customers this quarter, and here's what's blocking us from getting orders from them, thus, like, here are the features that they need to do business with us, nothing else you said really mattered a whole lot. And so I think that approach like led to extraordinary product discipline and engineering discipline. And hey, we're going to do whatever we can to solve our top 10 customers first. We'll carve out a little bit of time for strategic engineering, but we'll always solve our top customers' problems first. That was amazing, amazing, amazing discipline.
Mm. And how do you measure impact? Do you have like sort of metrics? Obviously, when it comes to a sales-led organization like Cisco, it's pretty easy. I mean, it's not, you would have those sort of metrics, but like for Google, you work in Google, you know, how would you measure impact there?
It's hard. I mean, that was always the hardest thing because it was this ethereal business. You know, there you had to measure the impact of people. There was a 6-month performance review cycle. And as I'm sure you've heard, the performance review cycle was a very, very, very top, constant top of mind topic for every single employee that I ever knew there, other than a very small gifted few. And so you're constantly measuring the impact of people. And at least the level that I was at, like, that was kind of, I hate to say it, like, fairly kind of the same as, you know, since one person only worked on one feature or like one small number of features, or if they were fairly senior, then certainly it's, you know, one kind of feature family or product, you know, one, you know, a couple different product releases. We would use them almost synonymously. And the best thing that I could say there is that it was done by big committees of people that had just seen lots and lots of people in the company lined up side by side. But okay, when I see 40 people, you can kind of spot here the top five that had the most impact over the last 6 months. So I think that that's unfortunately the best way to do it. In a small company, you don't get to run many parallel experiments. So you have to go time-wise and say, all right, in the 10 years that I've been doing this in the same industry, wow, we had a huge amount of impact in this quarter compared to 4 quarters ago or 8 quarters ago or what I saw. Yeah, we had much less impact than team had 14 quarters ago.
And you know, you built Big Switch Networks and you sold it to Arista in 2020, and you were there for 10 years. Was there like a conscious decision to sell the company, and then you also moved to Google, which is a big company? What was the experience of moving and selling the company and then moving to a big company?
I mean, after a 10-year journey, it was extraordinarily emotional.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was emotional not only as kind of this company or this organization has been a huge part of my life. I love, you know, Prashant Gandhi, our VP of product. He had this wonderful way of saying, he's like, Kyle, this is your life's work, you know.
Yeah.
Love it or hate it. For me, the big thing beyond that was just the relationships that I had with a bunch of great people. There are a lot of people at Big Switch that I consider to be very, 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 very close friends, and wonderful, wonderful people to work with. And, you know, when I decided to, I knew that I wanted to leave networking and pivot my own career. And for the most part, unfortunately, that meant that I wouldn't be working with a lot of the folks that really wanted to stay in networking for the rest of their careers. And that for me was actually, that wasn't like a conscious part, but I kind of knew that there was going to be something like that, because I knew that I was going to, you know, everybody else would talk about how much they love the networking industry. And I was like, I'm going to cloud. Whether it's Google or somewhere else, I'm going to cloud. So I always knew that that was kind of coming, but that for me was very sad. Obviously, I keep in touch with everybody personally, but these were wonderful working relationships with people that were extraordinarily talented and very dedicated, and that I miss working with very, very, very much.
Nice, interesting. And you know, I've been into early stage startups almost my entire life. I'm sure my wife would want me to work in a stable job, but you know, when you build a company, you will always have a lot of colleagues who would move on and, you know, build other startups. And I think that is where you see that sort of bonding with your colleagues who want to build other interesting things. What advice would you give to listeners who are listening to this podcast on if they want to start something on their own? Should they work in a big company like BCG, McKinsey, Bain, or Cisco? Or should they work in a smaller startup and then, you know, go on to build their own startup?
You know, so early in my career, I kind of had the amazing luck in like 2.5 years at Cisco to be the PM of 3 V1.0 products.
Right.
That's pretty rare. I mean, most people in a 10-year career might do like 1 or 2 V1.0 products there. And I got to do 3 in a small period. And I got to say, the product of building a V1.0 product there was not that different from building a startup. A huge amount of the same dynamics applied. The crossing the chasm, you know, how do you find the visionaries? How do you find the early adopters? How do you get across the chasm? How do you establish your reference, your first reference customer in the world, and your reference customer in every geography, and your reference customer in every geography in every vertical? So many of the issues were the same. I think to me, the big difference of doing in a startup is that, at Cisco, I was very junior, you know, junior levels. Like, I could spend like 95% of my time working on my product. At startups, you have like 50 to 60% of your time working on it, because you have to do fundraising and you have to figure out how to pay corporate taxes, because maybe you don't have anybody who can even help with that. And like, you have to figure out like business insurance. Like, you have to learn about that. Yeah, you do. You really do. And you have to buy business insurance. It kind of sucks. But like, yeah, at some point there's like, hey, we need an office. All right, who's going to pick the real estate? And you have to learn a lot about real estate. And you're like, wait, really? Like, I should be dealing with my customers. And here I am learning about triple net rent. You know, so when I went into Google, I went in as kind of much more senior executive. And then suddenly I found again, it's like, hey, I have to build these new products with 50, 60% of your time, because you actually have to deal with the corporate politics to keep your team funded and to keep your own role and to like build all of the alliances that are necessary to your left and to your right to keep your own stature in your organization to get all the headcount you need. So you're kind of back in this sort of similar situation of, man, this job would be so easy if I only had time in my day job to do my day job.
Yeah. No, totally get that. Especially, you know, you hired a lot of product guys in your career. What do you look for a product manager, and what questions would you ask him to figure out that, you know, this is a A-level employee?
And so I actually, it's funny you bring it up, because I actually counted. This was pretty soon after I left. As of 2 years ago, over the prior 10 years, I had interviewed 700 people.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
After I interviewed about my first 50, I had this wonderful executive coach, a man who I look up to very, very, very deeply, who's been a big part of my life for a long time. And he convinced me to do this exercise. He's like, hey, why don't you take your last 10 hires, write down what you thought after the interview, write down after 3 months kind of what you thought, and after 6 months, both what you thought and what kind of their performance reviews sort of shaked out to be.
Right.
And then I did it a second time with people where I had both interviewed them and I had checked references.
Hmm.
And my ability to predict roughly like strengths and weaknesses and what would show up on their performance reviews 6 months after hire, when I just did the interview, I was sub 40%.
Oh.
I mean, maybe I'm really am that far below the average. Maybe I'm not. When I spent time checking references, my ability to predict where somebody was going to land 6 months after starting was a little bit above 90%. I was 90%.
No.
It got to a point where when we were even hiring a professional CEO for Big Switch, I spent half an hour with the guy. That was it. I was like, hey, this meeting is not for me. It's for you. What questions do you have for me? I spent 5.5 hours checking references on him. I went all the way back to some of his college professors.
Oh, okay.
5.5 hours I spent on calls just doing reference checks. And so by the time that he started, I had a really, really, really good feel for the patterns that had shown up, you know, in his life before. That's my best advice is maybe you're a great interviewer and maybe I'm just really bad. I don't know. I only have numbers on myself. I have numbers on nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I know if I'm not checking references, then might as well just flip a coin.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a super interesting insight, but when it comes to reference checking, you know, how many people do you think, you know, one should speak to? Because, you know, I've been on interviews where they said, okay, we like you, can you give us two references? And, you know, and they would speak to those two references and that's about it. But looks like, you know, when you hire a CEO, I mean, you've done a great amount of referencing, but especially in a critical role, like that of a product manager or somebody in a sales role, you know, how much time do you think and how many people would you think, you know, you should go about speaking to? Especially, is it important to speak to their colleagues or they have worked with or just look at the references they shared with you?
Interestingly enough, I've found that as long as the person knows them well,
right,
the exact nature of the relationship doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
People immediately try to give me like the most senior executive that they've ever worked anywhere near, and that's nearly useless. And I've had plenty of people say, get really intimidated by it and wind up giving me the name of a college roommate, and those are extraordinarily valuable.
Yeah.
I'll say, hey, look, if you really can't think of three professional references, because maybe it's somebody who's coming out of their first job out of college.
Yeah. Right.
So they have a problem. They're like, look, all three of the people I give you, I work with them now, and I don't want to tell them I'm interviewing. So it's a simple logistical problem. I said, well, give me a couple friends. That's fine. That works out actually extraordinarily well. My particular method is that I always ask somebody to give me three references. And if somebody can't think of three former colleagues or friends,
yeah,
then we have maybe some other issue, but I'm certainly not going to get involved in that other issue. I call the first one and I always ask the first one for two other names. And sometimes it's overlap with one of the others. I always ask the first one about the other two that they've given me. And I say, hey, what do you know about these other two people? What should I know? Like, what's the relationship? I always ask the second person for another two names. And I sometimes don't even call the third name that they gave me. But I try to check at least one and sometimes two names that they didn't give me.
Mm.
If they can't give me those names, usually I'm hiring from within my industry. So I look at LinkedIn and like, it doesn't take me that long to find people that have worked with this person before that I trust. Usually this method of like, ask the first person for two more names, ask the second person for two more names, and make sure that you're checking three references to three to five references total. Work quite well.
Got it. Super interesting. And especially, you know, when, you know, founders who have limited resources and they're looking to hire somebody in product, what are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen, you know, founders when they're looking to hire their first product manager?
I've seen over and over people go for like, hey, oh, you have Google on your resume, you have Amazon, you know, they go for a sort of big name resume, which has many, many, many advantages, right? The person comes built in with a whole series of corporate processes that were built that often are worth emulating. But they mistake, you know, in the enterprise side, for example, they mistake a product manager who's spent a lot of time and had a lot of success with $5,000 to $10,000 products called the single player game. And they're hiring a person for the role of the massive multiplayer game type of product. And they just no resonance with what's required in that, you know, in that role. They don't realize that, you know, when you're selling multi-million dollar enterprise transactions, like as the head of product, like you're on a plane to meet your customers in person very, very often. Whereas for $5,000 and $10,000 ticket sale products, you're not even on a phone call with the vast majority of them. So very often I think that they either get the like, hey, this PM's been extraordinarily successful in $1 to $2 million sale products, but they've never done an SMB product or a low ticket price product or vice versa. And I've seen a lot of people make that mistake and they're like, wait, what? This PM hasn't met my top 10 customers and is spending all their time with marketing and trying to get some kind of statistics when we only have, you know, 30 customers, we'll build a $50 million business. You know, or the opposite, like, wow, they're talking about flying around for a customer that's a $20,000 purchase order, and yet they seem to have totally missed the data.
Right. And, you know, in your career, are there any big product mistakes you've made and, you know, and any learnings you've had, you know, making those mistakes?
Oh, my God, mistake. I mean, I got a long, long list on that one. Somebody says anything different, I think they're lying. I would say some of the biggest mistakes I made, we talked a bit about how do you balance the user versus the buyer.
Yeah.
Some of the, I'd say many of the biggest mistakes I've had were focusing on the wrong one of those two at the wrong time.
Right.
And conversely, some of the biggest wins that I've had have been when I got extraordinarily lucky and focused on one very specific feature, one very, very specific demo, or one very specific kind of aspect that really nailed it extraordinarily well with either the user or the buyer at just the right time. I do think that the question you asked before kind of to me goes at the heart of where you're going to have big wins and big, big, big mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I quickly wanted to do the top three. What's your favorite business book?
It's funny. I actually did a talk at Stanford. This is like 14 years ago or so. And I structured the talk of six different book recommendations. I'm going to pick one that wasn't on that list. Back at Google, I used to do all of these talks about Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. And if you like building V1.0 products, especially enterprise V1.0 products, if you haven't read that book, you're kind of missing out, because it's an amazing framework to organize the incredibly noisy amounts of feedback that you get back early in the process of building a V1.0. So Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, I'd put forward as it's probably my favorite business book. And then there's HBR, Managing Yourself, which I think is a series of articles, so it's a little bit of a cheat, but I would put that actually up there as well.
Got it. We'll put that in the show notes. And, you know, if you could go back in time when you started building products and now you're building Runvent, what is the one thing you would have focused on or done anything differently?
I would say, you know, there's something that, I mean, for me, I feel like I'm too old to go through Y Combinator, but there's something that, gosh, those Y Combinator folks just get right over and over and over and over again. And they just force everybody to do an incredibly disciplined set of hard conversations with potential users to try to figure out the pain point before they write any code, before they start prototyping. And I wish, I've had a number of products where I started prototyping thinking like, hey, we'll just do like a month or two of prototyping and then we'll show this prototype to a whole bunch of users and get feedback. And that 1 or 2 months of prototyping came like 4 or 5 months of prototyping. Instead of showing it to like 60 potential customers or 50, or I forgot exactly what the most recent Y Combinator name is, number is, showed it to like 10, but then like almost at that point in time, we already had ideas for where the prototype should go next. I think that those first 6 months of spending a lot of time, disciplined time, not building a prototype and instead just trying to figure out which problem to solve, it's easy to skip. It's just really, really easy to skip because it doesn't feel like progress, but it is progress.
Got it. Interesting. And do you have any favorite online tool, for example, Gmail, Slack, Zoom?
Maybe this is just kind of me showing I'm still so much an email person. And I mean, the early part of my career was pre-Gmail. I actually worked on Microsoft Exchange, the Microsoft email server, before Gmail came out.
Oh, interesting.
I had actually even, and I got that job because I had actually built a couple of tools like in Visual Basic, like Outlook plugins that I actually used for my own use. And they were part of my master's thesis. And every time I sit down, it's kind of sounds cheesy, but the Gmail interface for me is something that's pretty unique and was so groundbreaking at the time. And I still kind of appreciate the gigantic amount of user risk that first team took. And they didn't get it all exactly right, but they got a huge amount of it right and completely changed to me the world of business communication, the way that they had put together that early, early, early product. So it's less for what it is now, because now it's obviously very, very dated. I don't know if the user interface is dated, but email increasingly is becoming a dated form of business communication. Every time I use it, I still just think, gosh, two decades ago now, that team took a huge risk and their bets paid off.
Kind of interesting. And last thing, you know, you've been not part of Runvent. What led you to build this? You know, you left a Google and now you're building it. What are you trying to achieve? And, you know, maybe we can just talk a bit about Runvent.
I mean, the idea was born, you know, at the time for Google Cloud for Kubernetes. I can't give exact numbers, but we had a gigantic user base. But the user base was skewed to me in ways that like large and even medium and large traditional enterprises were a much smaller percentage of the user base than to me than a P&L like that size than they should have been. And I kept on looking like, hey, what's stopping them? What's stopping them? What's stopping them from adopting this technology that's to me clearly so much better? I mean, compared to running the exact same workload on VMs, it's like 30 to 50% cheaper, vastly faster, far, 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 far more tools to make it incredibly more reliable and upgradable. You know, why were we seeing, you know, across this particular segment, massively fast growing P&L, relatively slow adoption? And there were a number of patterns that came out that were the exact same that I saw at Big Switch with software defined networking. Organizations adopt new technologies requires a certain operational mindset, and some organizations do it very, very quickly, and other organizations are very, very, very scared And they're scared to me of an aspect that I'll just boil down without all the nuances is troubleshooting. When something goes wrong, how quickly can my team figure out what it is when this is a new technology that very few people on the team have ever seen before? And if we could kind of capture something in the bottle there that gets people through that hump. And I recognize there are a bunch of tools actually inside of Google, and Amazon has the same tools and Azure has the same tools because they do this all the time. Their tech stacks are so complicated that huge percentages of the team have never seen them before. If we could somehow take these tools the way that they've conquered this problem and bring these tools to enterprises that are constantly facing this problem as they adopt new technologies, then I think that the cycle of actually fundamentally enterprises adopting, especially new infra technologies, will actually get faster. We will create a massive flywheel of economic value for everybody if we can figure out how to crack this code. And I've played with a bunch of different ideas, and the big idea there became RunWin.
Got it. Interesting. And Kyle, you know, what are the best way people can reach out to you and know more about RunWin?
You know, at this point, I actually have a book a meeting link directly on my LinkedIn page.
Oh, nice.
So, and I'm surprised, you know, some people use it and a lot of people feel sheepish about it. I put it on there because we're at a wonderful stage in the business where the team isn't so large that 100% of my time has to be spent with the team. I just click that button.
Got it. We'll put that in the show notes. Kyle, thank you so much for taking our time and speaking to us. I really enjoyed my conversation with you.
I appreciate this. I appreciate this a lot. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the Life Self Mastery podcast, where we teach you how to start and grow your online business. For more information, visit Rohit's blog at www.lifeselfmastery.com.